Good morning. I'm Matt Schaefer. Welcome back to the Boston Sunday Review. Our guest in the studio is Jonathan McDowell, an astrophysicist with the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics and the Chandra X-ray Center. We've been talking about space, the problems with the International Space Station, what is SpaceX and orbital science, and how NASA's coming up. We're working on a new multi-purpose crew vehicle that'll be rolled out sometime this decade that eventually will be taking astronauts to Mars, the moon, and possibly asteroids. Speaking of the moon, China this past week landed on the moon. How big a deal is that?
Oh, I think it's a very big deal. This is the first time anything has landed on the moon since 1976. And it's a robot vehicle with a little robot rover on, a bit like the American Mars rovers. It really shows China's technical capabilities. It was a very sophisticated landing system. They've sent back nice pictures that the rover and the lander have taken of each other, which is also a big advance in China's PR capabilities, that they've really for the first time gone all out to advertise this, which shows how proud they are of it. And there's real science to be done in the Mare Imbrium, the Sea of Rains, as the rover rolls around. This is a new part of the moon that hasn't been investigated as much. So I think it really shows the maturity of the Chinese space program now.
When and why did the U.S. decide to abandon the moon?
Well,
and in retrospect, should we have?
I wouldn't say we abandoned the moon. I mean, we haven't landed there since Apollo, since 1972. In fact, the Chinese landing came, 40 years, is it, after
could
the last
we?
Apollo?
Do we have the technology to go back to the moon?
It'd take us a few years, but yes, we could. But, there are about four or five different American robots orbiting the moon right now. So we haven't abandoned the moon entirely. We have the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which is returning amazing photos of the lunar surface. We have the LADEE probe, which is doing its first investigations right now of the very thin lunar atmosphere, and the Artemis satellites, which are probing the things like the magnetic field of the moon.
And what's with the discovery of some moon rocks in like a cardboard box? Didn't we have all of the stuff we brought back from the moon fully cataloged and know where every single little stone was?
Oh, of course we do, yes. But
right.
You know how these things work, right? And
right.
20 years on, things get borrowed, people don't sign things out properly. It doesn't entirely surprise me that there's the occasional embarrassing moment like that.
What is the status of India's mission to Mars?
So that's the other side of the Asian space race, of course, with China, India, and Japan forge ahead with their space technologies. So the Mars Orbiter spacecraft it was launched into orbit around the Earth. They checked it out, and then on December 1st, they fired the engine to send it into orbit around the Sun. And it is going to get to Mars in September of 2014 and enter orbit around Mars, which is very ambitious new thing for the Indians to be doing.
And at apparently a cut rate price of $75 million.
Very cheap. They're using a rocket that they've used before to launch their Earth observation satellites. The satellite itself, the space probe, is based on their communication satellites. And so they've cobbled together, that's maybe an unkind word, they've put together a bunch of their existing technology to do a minimum mission. It's much cheaper than America's MAVEN Mars mission, which is also on its way to Mars right now. But to be fair, it has really minimal scientific capabilities. This is really an engineering mission to learn how to fly a spacecraft in deep space for the Indians, whereas MAVEN actually has real science on board.
How many NASA rovers are currently exploring Mars?
Well, we have two right now. We have the Opportunity rover, which is pluckily continuing its trek across the Martian surface since 2003. And we have Curiosity, the much more ambitious Mars Science Laboratory, which is exploring Gale Crater and has found evidence for clays and for a Martian past that is wetter and more hospitable to life than we had expected.
The announcement, you're referring to the announcement last week of the discovery that fresh water had once flowed on Mars.
That's right.
How significant?
It's a significant discovery. I would say it's not a surprise. We've sort of thought that for a long time, but this is, it's different to actually go and actually find the rocks and get the evidence. And I think the more surprising thing, the shift that's happening is that not only was there once water on Mars, but it was there was more of it there for longer in the history of Mars than we had originally thought. So this is really saying that the chances that there was once life on Mars is maybe a little higher than we had thought. And that's really exciting.
What is the Cassini mission?
Cassini is a mission which, if you haven't heard of it, you should really go and check out its website. Cassini has been orbiting the planet Saturn for about 7 years now, and it has returned images of the rings of Saturn and the moons of Saturn that are absolutely spectacular. So Saturn is this really complicated system. It has all these rings. It has a bunch of moons. Each moon is different. And so Cassini whizzes around Saturn. It keeps flying by Titan. Titan is the biggest moon of Saturn. You think moon, oh, moons are kind of boring, but Titan's really a world. It's like a planet almost like the Earth. It has an atmosphere. It has lakes. It has continents. Admittedly, the continent's made of ice and the lakes are made of methane, but it's a place that you could imagine visiting. And if you're into methane, well, you'd want to wear a spacesuit. But what we really want to do is we want a mission that will sail a boat on the lakes of methane lakes of Titan. That would be fun.
Is it true that proposed 2014 NASA budget cuts would gut the Cassini and/or the Mars Curiosity missions?
That's very likely. It's not clear exactly which missions would get the axe, but the planetary part of NASA is taking really big cuts in the proposed budget. All of the scientific part of NASA is really stretched right now. There's also tends to be a pressure in NASA to spend large amounts of money on the next mission and not to keep the old missions running. And
if the old missions are bringing back incredible science.
Right, because NASA wasn't invented to do science. It was invented to launch rockets. And so once they've developed the technology, the political backing is, well, no, we need to develop some new technology. And the interest in the science has always been a little secondary at certain levels of the agency. So the scientists have to fight back and go, yeah, you know, actually, given that you spend all this money, a little more money to keep the spacecraft running and actually return the science would be nice. But we'll see what happens. I'm optimistic that Congress will decide that really this science is worth doing and is exciting and should be funded.
What's going on with K2, the plan to bring the Kepler Space Telescope back to life?
Well, that's very promising. So Kepler was this amazingly successful mission that showed that astronauts were Kepler showed that Earth-like planets, Earth-sized planets, are very common in our galaxy.
So-called exoplanets?
Exoplanets. That just means planets that are going around some star that isn't the sun. And then Kepler stopped working just as it was really, you know, it'd be nice to get an extra year out of it, but it did pretty well. But now they figured out a way to make Kepler look at a new part of the sky, because it spent its whole mission looking at this one patch of sky in the constellation Cygnus. And at this new part of the sky, you can point at it without having the steering working quite as well and still get good results on other planets. So it seems like a good use, again, of existing hardware that you've paid for already and just put a little more money to get some really good science out of it.
Have they been coming up with evidence of hot dogs, aka dust obscured galaxies?
There are in that I haven't kept up to date with the latest work on dust obscured galaxies. There's been a lot of work in the submillimeter and in the far infrared, for example, with the Spitzer Space Telescope, on studying the dust obscured universe. And that's, you know, what happens when you have young stars is they put out a lot of dust that obscures their light, and that light then they become invisible to ordinary light, but very bright in infrared light. And so with the right telescope, you can see these dusty regions that you couldn't see before.
Is Hubble all fixed?
Hubble's working beautifully. It should work nicely for several more years, and we're, you know, going to get some really nice studies with the joint operations of Hubble and some of these other telescopes like Spitzer and Chandra that will look jointly at particular parts of the sky for very deep exposure and see very faint and distant galaxies.
Just recently, NASA released some spectacular photos taken by your Chandra telescope.
We're getting great data with Chandra 14 years into its mission. We're studying the way that the galactic center black hole swallows material. We're studying exploding stars. Every day we get a great new image from Chandra.
So basically you study things that happened millions of years ago.
Yeah, thousands to millions to billions of years ago. I actually look at quasars, which are the centers of distant galaxies where matter is being swallowed by a black hole. And a couple of my favorite objects, we see them as they were 4 to 5 billion years ago. They're that far away that the light has taken that long to get here from there.
What is the Square Kilometer Array Telescope being built in Australia, and how will it compare with other space telescopes?
So the SKA, the Square Kilometer Array, is a radio telescope that's being built partly in Australia and partly in South Africa. And it's really the largest radio array that's been made. So radio astronomy lets you study things like pulsars, which are collapsed stars that put out regular bursts of radio waves. It lets you study exploding stars like supernovae, and it lets you study the early universe with quasars, with early galaxies that are putting out radio waves. So it really is complementary to the other kinds of telescopes. You really need to look at all the different kinds of light, radio waves, infrared, visible, ultraviolet, X-ray, to get the full picture of what's going on.
And the giant Magellan telescope in Chile that's being constructed?
Right. Well, we've made the second mirror segment for the giant Magellan telescope. We're still raising money for it. But that's going to be a 30 meters class telescope that, again, will be bigger than anything we have right now. It's bigger, that does two things for you. It gives you sharper images, and you collect more light so you can see fainter things.
In the news, a theory that the universe is a hologram and we're floating inside.
Right.
Does that mean?
The Maldacena conjecture that quantum physics and relativity are related by this holographic principle. So the idea is that we think we're in a four-dimensional universe. Well, actually, physicists think we're in like an 11-dimensional universe, but seven of them are really small. The idea is that actually there's one less dimension than we think, that you can describe the universe. Let me put it this way. There's a way of describing the universe that requires one less dimension. And so you can have a representation of the universe that's only three dimensions, but which has all the information in the universe we perceive that has four dimensions, three of space and one of time. And by performing that mathematical transformation, you can understand, you can predict what's going to happen in the universe. So it's really a mathematical trick. And what the physical significance of it is, it's way too early to say. It's way too early even to say whether or not this result, I think, has any significance for physics. But it's an interesting, fun edge of modern physics result.
What happened to Comet Ison?
Oh, poor Comet Ison. So we were really hoping that Comet Ison was going to be spectacular. Comets tend to hang out nice and safe in the cold, icy wastes of the outer solar system tens of thousands of times further than the Earth is from the Sun. And every now and again, they do a visit to get a tan from the Sun. They fall in, whiz past the Sun, and go out again. But sometimes they come a little too close. And Comet Ison came close enough to the Sun. It's mostly made of ice. And the ice melted, and the thing fell apart. So we were hoping when it came out behind the Sun, it would have a nice, beautiful tail as all the ice was boiling away. But in fact, there was nothing left by the time it got past.
Do solar storms on the face of the Sun pose a threat to Earth that we are currently unprepared for?
Yes, they do. Solar storms. The Sun is a very active place, and if you look at some of the images from, for example, the Solar Dynamics Observatory that's taking HD video of the Sun, all the time there are these big explosions on the surface of the Sun. If we get a big enough one that heads towards Earth, the main risk is that it could take out the electricity grid. A big storm
the
could...
The entire planet's... electricity,
or maybe half the planet, something like that. Yeah, so it could bring down all the computers. It could really, for example, wipe out all the financial markets, all the
are we doing anything to possibly prepare for this, or is there anything you can do?
You can harden the systems. You can make backup systems that would come online if you lost the main ones. And I think there's some emergency work being done on that. There's some planning that people have done, but probably not enough, because we're talking about the sort of thing that happens once every couple hundred years. And so it's very easy to say it probably won't happen this year or the next.
But it could.
But it could.
And finally, why is Venus so bright?
So right now, Venus is whizzing around the Sun just past us. It's in the inside track. And so we're closer to it than we are normally. And it happens to be in a place where we see it in Boston in the early evening sky. So if you've been outside in the early evening, you see this one really, really bright thing in the sky. That's Venus.
Well, Jonathan, we didn't even get a chance to get to half of the questions that I had for you. So I'm going to invite you back early next year to continue the discussion, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely.
Meantime, folks can learn more and see some incredible images by visiting Chandra, chandra.harvard.edu. Jonathan McDowell of the Chandra X-ray Center at Harvard, thanks for joining us this morning.
Great to be here, Matt. Thanks.
You're listening to the Boston Sunday Review.